It is a great pleasure to welcome to Best Ideas 2021 Ken Majmudar and Sam Namiri. Ken is founder and managing partner. Sam is portfolio manager and partner at Ridgewood Investments. Ken founded Ridgewood Investments in 2002, serves as CIO with primary focus on managing the value investing based strategies. Ken graduated with honors from the Harvard Law School in 1994 after being an honors graduate of Columbia University in 1991 with a bachelor's degree in computer science. Prior to forming Ridgewood in 2002, Ken worked as an investment banker with Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers. Sam basically runs and concentrates his time on the Ridgewood Select Value Fund, the firm's fund focused on investing in small and micro-cap companies. Prior to Ridgewood, Sam was at Grand Slam Asset Management. He has a BS in Industrial Engineering and Operations Research from the University of California, Berkeley, as well as an MBA from Columbia Business School. Great to have you with us again, Ken and Sam. Really looking forward to this presentation. I'll now turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having us back. We really appreciate the opportunity, and we really appreciate the opportunity to be part of the MOI global community. We were used to actually seeing each other in person in Switzerland around this time of year, so we'll miss it this year due to the pandemic, but looking forward to coming back and seeing everybody in person again at some point. So we're going to start off our presentation. Here's our contact information. We'd encourage people to reach out to us at any time if you have questions or want to follow up on anything here or anywhere else. There's a couple of pages of disclosure. We're going to present a idea that we like, as well as share some information about our Select Value Fund that you mentioned, our small and microcap fund. So we just want to make sure that people don't just rely on this as investment advice, but to do their own due diligence and research. You've already shared our backgrounds. Sam and I work together at Ridgewood. Sam focuses 100% of his time on the Select Value Fund, as you mentioned, whereas I have broader responsibilities as founder of the firm. We are an SEC registered advisor with over 200 million in assets under management, with multiple strategies that we manage. Let's move forward. We're going to start with a little bit of a discussion of our microcap strategy to set the context, as the idea we're presenting is a microcap company as well. So this fund, which we started in April of 2018, so we've actually now, we're getting close to 3 years. We started this strategy together, Sam and I, after we actually met at a chance encounter at LD Micro, which is one of the best and most long-established microcap only conferences, which is held in Los Angeles every year. I'm based in the New York area and Sam is based in LA. We both had an interest in starting a fund focused on investing in small and microcap companies. And we love this area for a number of reasons. There's really a lot of companies to look at. There's a tremendous dispersion in the quality of the companies. It's very much an underfollowed area. There's a tremendous amount of activity, especially today in very large tech companies. There's been a giant sort of vacuum created in the smallest companies. Sort of similar to the Buffett playbook, we like to take concentrated positions, which means that we really have to know our companies well. So we do a lot of deep research. I know different people have different philosophies on meeting with people, but we actually think it's quite an advantage to be able to have access to the managements. So we find that with the smaller companies, having access both to meet them and to even visit the companies, we often do that with our holdings. We actually go to the company's headquarters and see them in their sort of native environment, try to assess the culture, assess the people, ask them questions when they're not as much on guard or trying to sell. all of these advantages that come from having access and openness that microcap companies offer, which gives us then conviction and enough research to, make and take concentrated positions. We also tend to take a quite a long-term investment horizon. We have fairly low turnover. We tend to build positions over time, and it's actually an even greater advantage because with many microcap companies, one of the other challenges you have is liquidity isn't as much there. So we tend to like to find great companies when they're small and underfollowed, buy them or accumulate them slowly, and hold on for long term. Some of our winners that have driven our performance have been very much in a longer term perspective where we've had multi-baggers, and some of these have done very well, and we still think they have good upside from here. One of the other areas for the Select Value Fund that's been quite fruitful is we take a private equity approach to public company investing, but in fact, we also have made private investments in public companies. I have an investment banking background, and even with the fund being relatively still a small fund, we have now done four investments where we negotiated or purchased a private security in a public company. We were able to structure a security that had asymmetric risk and reward. And typically in these situations, we had the opportunity because we were able to act quickly to solve an issue or a need for capital that the company had, and we were able to then negotiate very favorable terms, which has been very helpful. And of course, as I mentioned, we do emphasize really understanding our investee companies. So we take the time, we visit companies, we attend trade shows, and we really emphasize quality of management and capital allocation ability. In the microcap space, since these companies are smaller and sort of less followed, less proven, the level of average quality, I think it's safe to say, is definitely lower than mid and especially large caps, both of managements and boards. But we do occasionally find very, very good companies that have excellent management, and or companies where their management has been recently upgraded, and those tend to be particularly fruitful for us as a payback for all this sort of ground level due diligence that we like to do to get to know our companies before we invest in them and as we continue to hold them. So that's a little bit about our microcap select value strategy. And on this slide, I just want to share quickly for those who might have an interest, our results. As I mentioned, this is our results through the end of December 2020. Interestingly, if you told me last year at the end of Q1 that we would end the year as strongly as we did, I certainly would have been surprised and not been expecting it. But even though we had a negative 25% Q1, which was actually better than the microcap index that we most typically look at as sort of a general yardstick, we ended the year quite strongly. And so for the year of 2020, net of all fees and expenses, we generated 67%, just over a 67% return for the year. And then since inception, despite that, first quarter downdraft as a result of the pandemic, we've generated a very good total return as well as a great annualized compounded return for the entire duration of the fund. And it, not only great absolute return, which is what we go for, but also compares very favorably to the microcap space and even the S&P 500 and the Russell 2000. So we've had a very good year, and we are definitely open to hearing from folks that might be interested in this strategy or just learning more about it. In which case, please email Sam or myself, contact one of us, and we'd be happy to share with you some more details and also put you on our list of updates so we can give you informed and share more about what we're doing and our strategies, et cetera. So the investment idea that we're going to present today is one that we currently hold. It's a company that we've been familiar with for quite a few years, actually. I think I ran into this company at least 4 or 5 years ago. It's called CRA International. And since I was actually, Charles River is a river in Cambridge and Boston. And this company is the headquarters of this company, and it's located right in that area. I believe it's in, or it is, or it was near the Charles River. So CRAI is the ticker. The price as of the end of the day yesterday was 57.85. The market cap is 450 million. And Sam will walk us through some of the other details behind this investment opportunity and what our price target is and why we like it. What I'd like to share is that in general, we like, and I like businesses that have certain characteristics. And one of them is that, you know, a company that's relatively asset light. So in this case, Charles River Associates, it's actually an old company, by the way, as we'll touch on. It's been around for quite a while, but they have specialties in very boutique areas of consulting in a litigation context and management consulting in a variety of industries. And they have very good capital allocation in our estimation. And there's a bit of confusion around the way that they treat these forgivable loans that they use for recruiting and signing bonuses, which Sam will also cover. But in general, CRAI has a very solid business run by solid people, and has a relatively recurring nature in their business that generates good cash flows and good economics for the owners. And actually, Sam, if you want to jump over to just give folks a view of their website, and before you do that, let me just cover that slide there. The one that you just went to. So, as I mentioned, the company's been around. I actually, when I was at Harvard Law School, I also took some classes at Harvard Business School, and I was aware of Charles River Associates. So they had even back then, which was in the early 90s, they had a very good reputation as a very solid boutique consulting firm. And it wasn't even public back then, as you can see. So the firm was founded in 1965 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the Charles River runs through. So that's where the name comes from. And they IPO'd in 1998, and then they have grown since then through some acquisitions, both of talent and of small consulting firms. But the current CEO, he's been CEO for the last 10 years, and it was really one of the pivotal things was in 2016. When the stock was only $20 a share as compared to its $57 today, they kind of announced a fairly detailed and transparent capital allocation strategy, which makes sense and which has involved them buying back shares when it makes sense. So we're going to talk about that. But let's just jump over quickly to the website before I hand it off to you, Sam. So the website is crai.com, and they have a good investor relations section, as you can see on the upper right. But as you can see in their in this section, this is a list of their services. And what strikes me about it is not only that they're sort of a leading boutique global consulting firm, but how specialized their areas are. So, you know, when you look at this tab, you can look at things like very specialized areas. So what they have is roughly about 750 consultants in 20 offices in 9 countries, and these consultants, you know, specialize in certain areas. So some consultants work on things like transfer pricing or management consulting, which is a broader area, but some do things in an antitrust context with mergers and acquisitions, and some do forensic accounting, and some do you know, class action related, litigation related. So their two big areas are either for lawyers and law firms in a litigation context, or, you know, for very large Fortune, you know, 100 companies in these specialized areas. And because of this, you know, it's when you want somebody in something like, you know, hey, you have an antitrust issue, you know, the stakes are very high. You're going to really want the right people advising you And so you're going to look, and CRAI would be very high on your list because they might have 10 or 20 people in among their many consultants who that's all they do. And they've done it for other big clients and in high stakes litigation contexts. And the lawyers who deal in that area know them, have worked with them before. So even though any one project isn't necessarily recurring, the nature of their relationships with the clients and the stakes involved and the cost of bringing in a consultant relative to the stakes, that's what makes we think this business very sticky and very attractive. And obviously, it's all a people business, so it's also fairly capital light. Basically, the only capital you need is, you know, a little bit of office space, which probably even that people are rethinking with what's happened with the pandemic, and maybe a few computers, but otherwise it's just people providing services and traveling. So we really like that aspect. And if you want to just click over to the About Us, Sam, and just go down the page, you know, one of the things that we really like is just here, stop for a second. So the quality of their staff, you know, most of them have advanced degrees. It's very academic, rigorous thinking, very detailed type stuff. And it's team-based, so it's not just, you know, one person, although obviously there's key people among those 750 that have some of their client relationships, so retaining their people is an important thing. And if you just slide down a tiny bit more before we go back to the slide, they have the 20 offices in 9 countries, but if you look at their client base, and this is kind of a testament to their franchise, which, you know, they was started in 1965 and has been continuously operating now for you know, quite, you know, more than 50 years. So 83% of their of the Fortune 100 are their clients, and 94% of the Am Law 100. So these are basically the top global businesses are in the Fortune 100, and the top American law firms are in the Am Law 100. And so very high penetration among the top firms in the world because of their specialization, because of how long they've been around. So we think that this franchise is actually pretty attractive, and it would be pretty hard to replicate if you didn't have all of this that accumulated. And this is for a firm today that's worth $450 million. So we think that that's kind of notable. So Sam, why don't I hand it over to you, and you can go through some of the other details behind CRAI and what we've seen and what we like and what we think about it.
Do you see the slide that was on there? Okay, great. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, John, also for having us back on again. Really appreciate it. And thank you all for taking the time to listen. So just kind of, I'm not going to go over too much because Ken went over this quite a bit. CRA is a boutique consultancy firm. I think one of the things that's important as a US investor and US fund is that 75% of, sorry, 75, 80% of the revenues are derived from the US, 16% from the UK, and 4% from outside of those countries. And then also 75% of the revenues at CRA are from time and material versus 25% from fixed projects. And Ken mentioned most of the revenues that Charles River produces comes from the antitrust. That's a big niche that they have. And so you can that and surrounding that, the peripherals around that as well too. So I think the best way to kind of explain more specifically what Charles River does is to give some examples. And so here, this is one example of where the Aetna and CVS the acquisition, Charles River did some work in terms of, you know, working with them and helping them get through this the acquisition. And so one of the things or potential catalysts that we may see with the new Biden administration is a, potentially a big tech breakup. And so that would likely help spur some demand as well for their services. Another thing that recently that's helped them get through 2020 has been the increase in cyber attacks that happened from the transition, the mass transition from people to start working at home. And so they have a practice and they have specialists that help with cyber attacks and dealing with that. Also, you know, with the return of Joe Biden at the White House, and also the Senate's taken over, the Democrats taking over the Senate and the House, likely the CFPB, the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau, should increase its activity and probably target more large corporations and some of their practices that aren't very fruitful for the consumer. And so you can see here, there's an example of CRA working with credit acceptance in terms of, you know, addressing some of the monopolization allegations that they had.
Just a quick note, it's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There's just a quick typo on the slide. But
thank you. So yeah, let's talk about a little bit about why the opportunity exists here as a as what we think is a good investment opportunity. It really comes down to Charles River is a people-centric business, as Ken explained. And it's the people really that make the value of the business. It's their knowledge. And the way that historically consultants, you know, a company attracts consultants, it's very typical to get signing bonuses at the beginning of when they're hired. And so the way that this company has to account for the signing bonuses, a few years back, the SEC came and told them that you can't take that adjustment out of EBITDA. You can't use that in terms of amortizing the signing bonus over the life of the however long that's out there. So there's these forgivable loans and that's how they structure it. They give them a loan and they forgive it as time goes on, whether it's 2 years or 8 years. And so the company is allowed to give you both of these numbers, as you can see at the bottom of the slide. The graphic of the slide, they can give you EBITDA and they can give you the non-cash amortization of the forgivable loans, but they're not allowed to add it and give it to you together. And so the discrepancy here is that it's some people question whether those forgivable loans and the amortization of it is a recurring expense or not. And so at a recent conference, the CEO mentioned that less than 2% of the revenue in any given year is allocated to, you know, renewing one of these, I guess, signing bonuses. And again, just from talking to people in the industry, it is not normal and not typical to get another signing bonus from a company that you stay at. And another thing of note is that most in the last 5 years, nearly all the top revenue generators for Charles River have stayed on. And they haven't left. So the retention is really high. I think the number is less than 5%. And that's not an annual number. That's over the whole 5 years. It's less than 5%. So our belief is that there is a very small amount of this non-cash amortization that's really truly a recurring expense, and that most of it is actually not a real expense. And then the other thing that is really, really attracted us to this company, as Ken had mentioned, and part of our strategy in general is to look for companies that are really thoughtful about capital allocation, especially in the small and microcap space, particularly microcap. A lot of executives and boards don't even think about it, to be honest, and they don't have a strategy. So just to have in their investor presentation, for them to even mention it is already putting them in the top 5% of microcaps out there. So here you can see that they've redistributed a good amount of cash over the last 5 years, $116 million, directly to shareholders in terms of dividends and share buybacks. On this slide, I just wanted to kind of go over the remaining capital allocation strategy of talent and capital expenditures that you can see on the pie chart to the left. So I included talent and capital expenditures that they have in the pie chart, kind of lumped them together even though some of it may be overstated, in particular some of the CapEx of $73 million. But over this 5-year period, revenues grew by $150 million. And so their adjusted EBITDA that we assign to this company, again, assuming that the amortization of the forgivable loans gets adjusted out of EBITDA as well, the margin ends up being around 14%, the adjusted EBITDA margin. And so from the $150 million in new revenue they've generated in the last 5 years, using that back of the envelope math, we get around $21 million annually that has been added to adjusted EBITDA effectively. And so the total amount that was invested there was $181 million and over that 5-year period. So conservatively, you know, we believe that they've gotten 11% return on that invested capital over that time period. And again, that CapEx is very likely overstated because they've opened up some new offices. And also they redid their headquarters completely. Their headquarters isn't in Cambridge anymore. It's in Boston now in the John Hancock Tower. And they moved within that building and took over another 3 floors and built out like a brand new headquarters a few years back. So there's a decent amount of CapEx there. The CEO and management mentioned that their maintenance CapEx is actually around $3 million a year annually. So over that 5-year period, you know, wouldn't expect more than $15 million. But again, I just want to emphasize that our number of 11% that we measure is much more on the conservative side. And here you can see that they, you know, it's a perfect storm and it's a snowballing effect when you find a company that is generating good amount of cash flows and their share count goes down as well too. So this company over the last 5 years has been growing its revenue, it's been growing its free cash flow, and it's been reducing its share count. And in 2016 was when they really started their capital allocation strategy. They started giving a dividend and they started really, you know, again, really focusing on this. And yeah, I mean, it just kind of, you know, snowballed since, and we think it will continue to do so. And then just kind of one other thing is that we expect around 40% of cash flows at a minimum to continue to go back to dividends and share buybacks, which has been the case previously, as was shown on the pie chart over the last 5 years. And then again, this is a slide from their investor deck. And just to see the emphasis on stock repurchases, on cash dividends, you know, in addition to the growth and operations of the business, you know, that again just creates this great value creator, and time really becomes our friend. And even if the stock price goes down, it's, in our opinion, it's temporary because that just allows them to buy back more of their shares with the same amount of capital. So yeah, the share price, as we mentioned today, is in the $57, $58 range. And, you know, at this price, the stock was a lot cheaper in April. And, you know, the question is, do share buybacks make sense today? And we believe so. And I'll run you through the basic math is that, you know, we think that $500 million in revenues is kind of our base case scenario over the next 2 years for this company. And with the 14% operating cash flow margin that they're pretty much been doing for a little bit of time now, that comes out to $70 million of cash flows a year. And backing out the $3 million in maintenance CapEx that management says they spend, then you get a yield of 15%, 15% when you buy back your shares at today's price, which I think is quite attractive. And again, as time goes on, we believe that this business should do better on a per share basis. And then that yield should even increase. So I kind of want to bring everything together and kind of get to how we get to our valuation of CRAI today. Typically, we model out 2 years when it comes to predicting a value of a business. A big portion of that is because as someone who's operated a business myself, like you typically don't even budget past 1 year, And then also after 2 years, it becomes just way too difficult to actually project what happens. And so that's usually when we create our models, we do it off 2 years, and then we give a multiple valuation after that. So assuming the $500 million revenues, which they've done $490 in the last 12 months, and in March, a lot of M&A activity just stopped and the courts stopped or closed down. So, you know, that's kind of a depressed, the 490 that they have the last 12 months is a little bit of a depressed number. So we think 500 is very reasonable and achievable. And so based on the margin, the 14% margin, you get to the $70 million cash flows a year. And we're assuming $30 million on dividends and buybacks get spent. So then they have $40 million left that they'll allocate to growth. And based off of our return on investment capital that we did earlier of 11%, our conservative number, I'm only assuming that they're going to get 10% on that $40 million spent. So we're giving $4 million of value each over the next 2 years. So we think at 2022, you increase your cash flows from 70 to 78 million, and you know the revenues will get up to 550 million with the 40 million spent on growth. And also on the balance sheet wise, the cash distributed to shareholders should grow by 60 million over the next 2 years. So the first two lines here kind of repeat the last slide. And so I'm going to go and, you know, based off the current multiple of our cash flow proxy that we have of 7x, which is what it trades at today, is 7x. As we think cash flows increase to 78 million over 2 years, giving a 7 multiple gives enterprise value of 546 million. And then 60 million gets redistributed out back to shareholders in terms of buybacks and dividends. Although it's hard to tell what the stock will do over the next 2 years, so it's difficult to estimate what the share count will be. However, I just add back that 60 million of cash as if it wasn't actually used, and so that's how I get a market cap of 606 million. The share price, the share count, I assume no buyback, so stay steady at 7.7 million. And so there you get a share price of $78 per share with the current multiple. So this is kind of our base case scenario. I would say kind of a low case scenario in a way. And so that gives you a 34% return from today's share price. And then we have additional upside if we can get the multiple re-rated here, which again, with size, with some more sell side coverage, I think that could be possible. There's currently three analysts covering the stock, and I think there's room for more. And so if you look at the comparable companies, FTI Consulting, ticker FCN, trades at 1.8 sales, 15x cash flows, and 14x EBITDA. They're about 10x the size of Charles River. So that's one of the reasons likely for a multiple. And for the bigger multiple that these companies have. And then also Huron Consulting, you can see trades at 1.4x sales, 8.1x cash flows, 16x EBITDA. Charles River trades at about 1x sales. So, and then assuming that they're able to get a 10x cash flow number at our $78 million free cash flow that we get. With you know, I'll get to 780 million enterprise value, and then again add back the 60 million that they should put into that they're going to reinvest in with distributions of dividends and share buybacks. You get a market cap of 840, and keeping the share count flat, the price target then gets pushed up to $108 a share at the end of 2022, which is 86% return from today's current share price. And so, yeah, and the other thing I just wanted to mention as well too is that we're not counting on an acquisition, but it would be very accretive for one of these larger consulting companies that we have as comparables to acquire them at a premium of today's price that is trading at. And you know, even our target price here of $108 a share, that's still lower than the multiple of FTI Consulting, and it's higher than the Huron Consulting cash flow multiple, but still, it still would be lower than what they have to report as on EBITDA as an EBITDA multiple for Charles River. So I think that an acquisition is also something that's very that could be could actually happen and extract the value again for us as shareholders at of Charles River. And the risk here is that just some of the things our model assumes is that the company can get some growth and maintain its margins. So there is risk that in a short period of time that may not happen. And also, again, like kind of similar to what happened in March, when there is an economic downturn, companies will get scared of doing M&A and be hesitant, and M&A activity can drop, and that does hurt their business. And also, you know, if they're not able to retain their employee and consultant turnover, that's also a risk. And also, if they're unable to deploy excess capital poorly, like for instance, if the stock goes up quite a bit, you know, they're buying back shares at the wrong time and then not buying shares when the stock is down. So, but again, management has a pretty good history of deploying capital well. If you look at Glassdoor, the reviews of the company are quite high. So I don't think the employee and consultant turnover is too much of a risk as well too. And with low interest rates, I think that M&A activity should pick up quite a bit, especially as we come out of COVID and people, you know, get scared or and then they want to join bigger companies, they want to sell their businesses and such. So yeah, that's the end of our presentation.
And just one thing to just sort of finish it off in terms of context is that I do think, and I have thought about this, company is a very good quality business with pretty low downside. And it's interesting, and this was deliberate that we're presenting this right now in a backdrop where the best performance is being driven by you know, particularly large technology companies and a lot of these SPAC companies that are going public with little revenues and very high multiples. It does remind me quite a bit because I was investing at the time of the internet boom in the late 90s. And I believe that now, as happened then, there will be a swing of the pendulum. And I believe it's also going to be the case that now, as happened then, a very small number of these companies will eventually justify the valuations that they're being assigned. But a very large number of these companies, the expectations are far, far ahead of anything that will possibly happen to them. And so investors that are buying into these sort of stories with very little to back them up, you know, all on future hopes and dreams, a number of those investors are going to get hurt, and their hopes and dreams are going to be dashed against the reality of what actually ends up happening. And meanwhile, you have a lot of companies, and particularly in the smaller companies and the microcap companies that we focus on, companies like Charles River, where they really have very solid businesses and they're very well positioned. They're generating good cash flows. And yeah, you know, they're not going to grow to become 10 times their size in 5 years. I think, you know, there's a good chance that when the bloom comes off of that rose from the SPACs and the tech high flyers, there'll be a swing back to good businesses and good cash flowing companies with solid growth potential, especially so since we're kind of still seem to be in a low interest rate world with a lot of money being printed. You know, we think that that will be a tailwind that will shift from a headwind to a tailwind, in, you know, in the fullness of time. Of course, you know, hard to predict when that happens, but we like companies like this with solid, real businesses and growth potential and a low valuation and good cash flow.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Ken and Sam, for this presentation. Maybe just a couple of questions from me, and then I'll encourage our members to follow up with you guys directly, either on this specific idea or more broadly about microcap investing and your fund focused on that space. Ken, you mentioned that you've known the company or of the company for quite a long time. And just looking at the chart of the last 20 years, it hasn't really been a compounder in terms of the stock price. You know, like 20 years ago, it was about half the price where it is today. And somewhere around 2005 to 2007. It was actually trading close to where it is today. Can you shed a little bit more light on why it didn't compound during that period? And, you know, why going forward you feel like this, they're going to have good returns for shareholders?
Yeah, so I really encountered, well, I knew of the company. I actually interviewed with the company, I think, at one point when I was in Cambridge as a graduate student. Didn't end up, I don't think I got an offer, and I don't know that I would have wanted to go there anyway. But it had a respected name. So back then, even in the sort of early mid 90s, I knew Charles River Associates was a respected consulting firm. And it had a good business. But it was a private business for a while. And then I don't think the capital allocation was as good or as disciplined. And I think the shift came in, even though the CEO was joined the company and became the CEO in 2010, he had something of a epiphany on the capital allocation side. And I think that shift really occurred in sort of 2016 or so. So we met with him a number of times, and you know, all of these differences in terms of the buybacks and the way that they do the dividends, how they think about these forgivable loans as a recruiting tool, and how that's misunderstood. And they actually do, we didn't mention this in the slide, but they really do think the economic value added framework, where you look at your cost of capital and then you look at how you're deploying capital, and are your decisions in terms of allocating your capital actually creating value above your cost of capital? That's something that we've heard the CEO and some of his team talk a lot about that. So I think it's a little bit of sort of a new regime. And we have a couple of other companies. In general, like, small companies are not good capital allocators, and they typically just stay that way. But occasionally, they do change their policy, and we believe that Charles River may be in that bucket.
In terms of capital allocation going forward, you know, you showed that chart or the mix of how they allocate. I would like to understand a little bit better the, you know, reinvesting in talent, and how you feel about, you know, the fact that the talent basically walks out the door every night. Just talk a little bit about, you know, your confidence going forward that they're going to be able to retain the best talent, that the compensation ratio won't change materially, and so forth.
Yeah, I think in terms of the compensation ratio and stuff, I don't have much of a concern, because they're quite stable across time. And so, you know, it's like any of these service businesses, and I just generally like service businesses, consulting businesses, if they're run well with a good culture, which I believe CRAI does have that. When you're, say you're a senior person who's an expert in antitrust or any one of these areas that they specialize in. And by the way, this is actually a true thing. Like, sometimes many of these folks, you know, some of their consultants, they may also have an academic appointment somewhere, but they also have a consulting business on the side. Sometimes the consultants are actually, before they become part of CRA, they have their own independent consulting practice that happened to grow out of their area of expertise, or a book they've written, or they've been teaching courses or whatever. And so over time, CRA recruits people like that. And they say, hey, you know, you're doing this consulting practice on your own, come join us. So part of the inducement for that, which is one of the ways that they allocate capital, is they find these folks and they say, hey, you know, we will essentially kind of recruit you / buy your consulting practice. And to do that, we'll give you this, it's a forgivable loan. So essentially right now we give you this much cash up front. Your team joins our company and you stay for a certain amount of time. And each year that you stay and you're generating revenue and EBITDA for us, we're forgiving a piece of that loan. So essentially you've gotten a cash amount up front, And then over time, that amount that you owe back to us, it's not yours yet, gets reduced over time. So that's why we were adding that back, because what happens is you have these clients, you have, you know, your staff, you have the logistics of, you know, sort of being in one place, you have your business cards of, you know, call CRAI. And so you'd think like, oh, well, you know, every year or every 2 years or every 3 years, you'd have to renew everybody's consulting agreement, let's say, and pay them more money to stay. But they're, in the reality, there's certain stickiness that comes. And, you know, there's risk when you move. Like, for example, you leave CRAI, now you go to some other place, and you may not like the culture, or it may not quite end up being what you expected. And your clients, now you have to tell them you've moved, your email has changed, your business card has changed. Maybe some of your staff stayed. So all of that stuff ends up being disruptive. And so there's a certain stickiness that comes with, you know, the inconvenience of having to move every X number of years. As Sam mentioned, the typical recruiting deal where they give them up front is 2 to 8 years. So some are longer, some are less. Sometimes they do have to renew them for whatever reason. But in every case, they look at what they're giving and what they're getting. And there is a certain inertia that benefits you when you have a good culture and you have a stable platform. And by the way, when you're in a small scale and you join a bigger firm like this, there's some cross-selling opportunities. There's certain things that you don't have to worry about anymore. And that overall package gives it a certain amount of recurring stickiness, both from the same thing from the client side, right? Clients, if you're a lawyer, you've worked with CRAI and they've helped you with XYZ antitrust action, it's the path of least resistance. You know, you're not going to care, I mean, to save 10% or 20% with somebody else when you have all of this ease of doing business and trust built up. And the same thing applies on the consultant employee side. Yes, everybody leaves and goes home every night. I mean, now with the pandemic, you're not even coming into the office essentially. But, you know, the inconvenience of moving platforms typically means that the retention and the stickiness is much greater than you would think based purely on a mercenary type of calculus.
And it sounds like, as you mentioned, it's a capital light business, and perhaps, you know, their need for office space may even decrease going forward if there's more remote work. So do you see the vast majority of free cash flow going toward share repurchases going forward?
I think there, if you go back, Sam, to that slide, both this, the repurchase slide and the pie chart where you showed where they did the capital allocation. So just when you just go to the repurchase slide real quick. So this is pretty unusual. I mean, I would say that one thing that constrains them is, you know, they only have 7.7 million shares outstanding. So it's quite a low base of shares out there. And so their trading volume on a daily basis is also fairly light. So, you know, that would probably be one of their concerns, but it hasn't stopped them from buying back shares. You know, typically in a people intensive business, a lot of times companies keep issuing a lot of shares, like especially these tech companies. So you don't actually see the share count going down like this. So this, I think, is really good. And as we said, we do expect them to maintain about 40% of cash flows going towards dividends and share buybacks. Now, if you go forward, Sam, to your pie chart, you know, certainly, as you see, they've been basically spending about 40% to dividends and buybacks. This is over a five-year period. Right. And so I would expect that they would probably keep this rough mix. And as Sam pointed out, perhaps the CapEx would on a prospective basis would be too high, because the actual maintenance CapEx is actually fairly low because it's capital light. So this might have some you know, some new offices and some new space and things like that. So perhaps that number could be lower. And where will that go? I would expect it to, you know, probably be a little opportunistic. And so, yes, there is a potential for maybe going forward a higher percentage towards either dividends or buybacks. By the way, the people are a significant owner, so that we like to see that, you know, sort of alignment of interest. When I say the people, I mean the management and the employees are significant owners, though I don't have the number at my fingertips. And then opportunistically, I mean, certainly, especially potentially with the disruptions that have happened, if you have a good culture, there are still a lot of these areas. They're still a small company. That's another thing that we like about small caps and micro caps is you're still a small fish in a relatively large pond. So I think they'll still have good opportunities if they have less in CapEx to grow from acquiring talent, acquiring smaller firms, and or buying back shares and or increasing their dividends. So I think all of that will continue going forward, but perhaps increase to your point, because their actual CapEx is probably lower than this if you were looking at it and stripping out growth CapEx.
Makes sense. More generally now, I'd be curious if you could talk about your idea generation in the microcap space and for your microcap fund.
Yeah, sure. Well, like we, and this is interestingly enough, like the way I met Sam is we were both at a microcap conference, as I mentioned. But we like to, you know, we read broadly. We like to meet the people. So one of the nice things when you go to these conferences, which we do multiple times a year, and they've continued virtually, I find the virtual is not as good as in person, because also there's the informal connections. For example, Sam and I met at the MicroCap conference, and neither of us was presenting there. We were just there as participants. So, but what we do at the MicroCap conferences is we literally have a full day after day of either one-on-one meetings with companies, or we attend the presentations. I think in Sam's case, he tends to do more of the one-on-ones, and I tend to kind of go around and look at the different companies and just pop into their presentation. Sometimes I'll pop into multiple presentations, and I'm just looking for certain factors, like if the person seems like they're really on the ball and they understand something about capital allocation. Certain industries, certain types of businesses like consulting, for example, I tend to like more. And then there's areas that I tend to avoid, like biotechs, where it's all a story, but there's no real revenue or profit to look at. Not that there can't be great investments there. I'm not qualified to judge a company based purely on its, you know, biotech research papers. So that's been a big source of inbound idea generation. But we also could get ideas from articles we read, transcripts, other microcap investors that we know who we respect. And even we ask managements of companies that we respect, what other companies do you respect? So all of those have been fruitful sources. And there's even, you know, there's even like, you know, communities, forums where, you know, investors share ideas. So all of those have been sort of top of the funnel inputs. And then they go through our filters. And then we would spend a lot of time with the companies before we would get enough conviction to, you know, maybe start to accumulate. And again, a lot of times as we're talking to them and we get to know them through relationships. I mean, we had a company that we have a significant position. We've gotten to know the CEO quite well. He's excellent, wonderful guy. In fact, we considered presenting it. It's just not so cheap as this one. You know, we spoke to him relatively recently and he said, hey, you know, we talked to you guys, you've been a holder. You guys said we're long-term holders, and we were one of the few of their investors who actually bought more stock when it fell down and it got to very attractive levels. But it's because of those connections that we make in the real world, then we end up getting those opportunities that I mentioned on the private side, where there's a certain amount of trust, and our trust and our ability to act quickly meets a need that a company has. And during those times, we've just done really tremendous deals where the risk reward is very asymmetric by design. We negotiate it. And so those, we've done four of those in the fund that have worked out so far.
And geographic, sorry, Sam, were you going to?
Yeah, I was going to say, just and kind of add to that, another idea generation source is just from doing due diligence. Sometimes you'll be due diligence on one company, and then as you speak to a former employee, you know, I one time went and spoke to a former employee at an online sports gambling company. This was quite recent, and he referred me to another company that he was working with now. And, you know, that was a company that really no one had ever heard of. And it was trading on a foreign exchange in Canada that, again, a lot of Americans or a lot of investors hadn't heard of it. And it was, you know, that was a great, I mean, and right now it's been a great investment so far. And so that, again, just by happenstance, sometimes you just run into good investments or good ideas just based upon, you know, building a network and doing due diligence. And also IR people will contact me as well too. With new companies that they have as that they're representing. And so I think just kind of being in the microcap network of people and being around it for a while has brought on a good amount of ideas.
Yeah, the intermediary thing is an untapped resource too. So IR people and also investment bankers mm-hmm. is another one. I, as a former investment banker, you know, they're intermediaries. So they're trying to match make between investors and companies. And you know, obviously on one side, they generate fees. So they have to, you know, they're trying to earn their living, and that can pressure them in certain respects. But on the flip side, you know, we're very clear, like, here's what we're looking for. If you find something like this, then that's for us, you can bring it to us. And once people get to know us and they know what we're looking for, because we're clear about it, sometimes we get very good, like, recommendations or introductions. And in the case of investment bankers, you know, they say, hey, well, you know, we're working with this company. They need this much capital in order for us to do this other thing with them, which we want to do. You know, would you want to do that? And that's where we can say to them, you know, yes, we can move quickly. We like the company. We're willing to do this much as a sort of a bridge round. But our terms, you know, and our cost of capital will reflect that we're moving quickly and we're providing something that's not that easy. And so sometimes we get those opportunities through bankers, and we see that happening increasingly as the fund matures.
And I was going to ask geographically, Sam, you mentioned the Canadian company. To what extent do you guys look outside the US, and is that then a global search, or do you stick more with North America?
We're open to global, but there's actually a good amount of opportunities of US / like US businesses. We try actually stick to the US in general as well too, just because we know it better. But there's a lot of companies that just list in other exchanges, whether it's London, Australia, Canada, and there's a good amount of arbitrage in valuations there. And also likely because a lot of, you know, capital in the US can't or doesn't invest outside of the US. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of capital today is momentum driven, and the momentum is in large US companies. So, you know, both US small and micro cap areas, as well as international, more or less across the board, are all out of favor. And there's plenty of opportunity in all those areas. But being that we're both in the US, you know, we'll probably focus more of our time and attention. It's easier for us to get there on a US sort of micro cap than it would be, you know, on a small cap or a micro cap elsewhere. But it's not that we have done them before, and we have got, we have multiple of those in our portfolio at different times. But most of the portfolio is US based.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I will leave it there. I just invite fellow members to reach out to you guys. It's been a wonderful session. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Take care for now.
Okay, bye.